Today is Wednesday, August 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Mali's president resigned Tuesday.
Protesters have been calling for Keita to resign, blaming him for corruption and worsening security in the north and center of the West African country, where Islamist militants are active.
Plus, the final bipartisan report on Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. election was released.
Number of people with the 2016 Trump campaign had regular contact with Russian intelligence services and expected to benefit from those contacts.
And how humans can achieve super strength. We'll have these stories and more next. Mali President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita resigned late Tuesday and dissolved parliament hours after soldiers detained him at gunpoint. Reuters' Gloria So starts us off.
Officier.
Mali's President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita resigned on Tuesday and dissolved parliament, plunging the country into deeper political crisis amid military mutiny and mass protests. Protesters have been calling for Keita to resign, blaming him for corruption and worsening security in the north and center of the West African country, where Islamist militants are active. Wearing a surgical mask, Keita resigned in a brief address broadcast on state television.
If today certain elements of our armed forces want this to end through their intervention, do I really have a choice?
Keita's address came shortly after mutinying soldiers seized him and several other top officials, detaining them at the Kati military base outside the capital Bamako earlier on Tuesday. It was not immediately clear who was leading the revolt, who would govern in Keita's absence, or what the mutineers wanted. But hundreds of anti-government protesters poured into a central square in Bamako to celebrate Keita's rumored detention. They cheered on the mutineers, who drove through in military vehicles and fired rounds of celebratory gunfire. International reaction to the news has been swift. France and other international powers, as well as the African Union, denounced the mutiny, fearful that Keita's fall could further destabilize the former French colony and West Africa's entire Sahel region. The United Nations also called for the immediate release of Keita and other detainees.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News. The ouster of Mali's president and government drew international condemnation. The soldiers who have led the coup promised on Wednesday to restore stability and oversee a transition to elections within a reasonable period. The UN Security Council will be briefed on Mali behind closed doors Wednesday afternoon in New York. The European Union held a virtual meeting on the situation in Belarus, where protesters have continued for more than a week calling for the resignation of President Alexander Lukashenko. Belarusian opposition politician Svetlana Tikhanovskaya appealed to EU leaders not to recognize the election results.
For the second week in a row, my nation is fighting peacefully for its constitutional right to elect its leaders. The August 9th elections were neither fair nor transparent. The results were falsified.
Following the EU session, I spoke to Catherine Field in Paris, France.
The key point from this meeting has been that the EU, that's the 27 members of the EU, consider that the elections were, and I quote, neither free nor fair, and that they do not recognize the results. The situation, they all said, is increasingly concerning to them, and that is because they are concerned of any violence. Let's not forget, Belarus is right on the eastern flank of the European Union's member states. They do not want uncertainty, they do not want violence, they do not want unrest on that eastern flank. So they're concerned about violence as much as they are about the rule of law and the democratic aspirations of the people of Belarus.
So what can they do?
It's very difficult for them. If they go too far, then they risk upsetting the Russian President Vladimir Putin, who, of course, does consider Belarus to be his, what the Russians call their near abroad, their very clear sphere of influence. So what they are doing, the European Union has said that they will have targeted sanctions against individuals they consider responsible for the violence that followed the elections and for those who are responsible for the falsification of the elections. They are not going to be sanctioning all the leaders just outright. It's going to be very targeted, specific people. They say that they will come up with this list in the next few days.
So I guess the big question is, how does this affect the European Union as a whole?
It's a real concern for the European Union that they do have this eastern flank that is not really within its orbit, so to speak, that it's not being influenced, if you like, by the European Union over the decades talking about the need for Europe to all be having a respect for the individual and a respect for the electoral process. And I think the fact that you also see that at this meeting today, the leaders agreed that they will put 53 million euros into the Belarus civil society to help them and not directly to the Belarus government. I think that's interesting to see yet again. We saw that in the Lebanon. We're seeing it here in Belarus, that they're going directly to civil organizations, civil society, not governments. And that's very important because they're essentially saying, we don't like what you're doing and we're not going to deal with you, but we are going to deal with your population. And in that, we've seen they're going to give 50 million euros to the health service to help engaging with COVID. They're also going to give 2 million euros to help the victims of repression in that country. And they're going to give 1 million euros for civil society groups. These civil society groups who talk about fundamental democracy and freedom and who are there on the ground helping to make that peaceful democratic transition happen.
Catherine Field reports from Paris. Democrats formally nominated former Vice President Joe Biden as their candidate for president on Tuesday, the second night of their virtual convention. The evening included criticism of President Donald Trump from Republicans as well as Democrats, and personal stories of Biden as a public servant, father, and husband. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekuswara has that story.
Capping the second night of the Democratic National Convention, the woman who could be the next First Lady, Jill Biden, highlighted the pandemic's impact on children and families and spoke of her husband from a high school classroom where she used to teach in the Biden's hometown of Wilmington, Delaware.
How do you make a broken family whole? The same way you make a nation whole. With love and understanding. And with small acts of kindness.
Just as on the first night, Republicans lined up to support Biden, including a testimony from Cindy McCain, wife of the late Senator John McCain, and Colin Powell, the retired four-star general and Secretary of State under President George W. Bush, who said Joe Biden would make a responsible commander-in-chief.
For Joe Biden, that doesn't need teaching. It comes from the experience he shares with millions of military families, sending his beloved son off to war and praying to God he would come home safe.
Their presence highlights the wide tent message of unity that Democrats want to convey, targeting moderate Republicans and independents. But ideology is not the only divide the Democrats are seeking to bridge. On Tuesday, they focused on another divide, the generation gap, with members of the old guard sharing the spotlight with young rising stars.
You know what Donald Trump will do with four more years? Blame, bully, and belittle. And you know what Joe Biden will do. Build back better.
We stand with Joe Biden because this isn't just about defeating Donald Trump. We are in this to win for America.
Everything is done virtually, including the traditional roll call, where delegates cast their votes based on the result of each state's primary or caucus. Vanessa Beasley teaches presidential rhetoric at Vanderbilt University.
We're going to look back on this and call it the Zoom convention because I think some of the moments that might have seemed awkward or might have seemed like the picture was a little grainy, I think that's part of many of our lived experience now. And more to the point, is in fact how we are having relationships in some cases with coworkers, family members, people that we care about.
On Wednesday night, the Democratic National Convention will continue with California Senator Kamala Harris delivering her acceptance speech as the vice presidential nominee, making history as the first Black woman and South Asian American on a national U.S. political ticket. From Wilmington, Delaware, Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
Speakers at tonight's virtual convention include Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, former President Barack Obama, and vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris. The Senate Intelligence Committee issued a report as it wraps up a three-year bipartisan investigation of ties between the 2016 Trump campaign and Russian intelligence services. AP correspondent Tim McGuire has more.
The Senate Intelligence Committee concludes that a number of people with the 2016 Trump campaign had regular contact with Russian intelligence services and expected to benefit from those contacts. Virginia Senator Mark Warner, ranking Democrat on the committee, says the Russians had
unprecedented amount of Russian intervention and a myriad of contacts with individuals affiliated and associated with the Trump campaign.
The committee labels those interactions a grave counterintelligence threat. The findings echo, to a large degree, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. The investigation also dismisses President Trump's claims that the FBI had no basis to investigate. Trump has repeatedly called the investigations a hoax. Tim McGuire, Washington.
Former FBI lawyer Kevin Kleinsmith is expected to plead guilty Wednesday in federal court to falsifying a document. The case is part of the Bureau's own examination into whether it acted properly in investigating allegations that President Donald Trump's 2016 campaign colluded with the Russian government. Kleinsmith is the first person criminally charged in an investigation by John Durham, a federal prosecutor tapped to probe mistakes by the FBI when it sought a warrant to conduct surveillance on former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. Still to come.
Anybody who's wearing the Guardian XO can lift up to 200 pounds. It really augments your strength, your performance. You move the way you normally would move. So if you were to go to grab something to lift it, that responds to your movement and gives you that strength to do that activity.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Iran has surpassed 20,000 confirmed deaths from the coronavirus. Wednesday's announcement comes as Iran struggles with the largest outbreak in the Middle East. Despite the somber statistics, the Islamic Republic is holding university entrance exams for over 1 million students and is preparing for mass Shiite commemorations at the end of the month. Pope Francis warned against any prospect that rich people would get priority for a coronavirus vaccine. The Pope said that the world can't return to normality after the COVID-19 pandemic if normal means social injustice and degradation of the natural environment. Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 tracker currently counts 22.1 million confirmed cases, 14.1 million recoveries, and over 780,000 deaths. Five different vaccines against COVID-19 are in the final phase of testing. They follow three different strategies, including novel approaches. VOA's Steve Barragona has a look at how they aim to work.
The main target for every vaccine against the coronavirus is the spike protein that sticks out of its surface. That's the part the virus uses to get into our cells, causing an infection. The goal is to get the immune system to make antibodies that stick to that spike, says University of Maryland infectious disease doctor Jim Campbell.
It will prevent the virus from being able to enter your cells. And that is like, you know, that's the holy grail here.
One route to this holy grail is by injecting whole inactivated viruses, says vaccine expert Paul Offit.
Take a virus and you grow it up, and then you inactivate it with a chemical. By inactivate it, what that means is the virus cannot reproduce itself. That's the way that we make the hepatitis A vaccine. It's the way that we make the polio vaccine. It's the way that we make the rabies vaccine.
The immune system makes antibodies to the inactivated virus, so it will be ready if the real thing comes around. Two Chinese companies are trying this method. A newer method uses a different, weaker virus as a delivery vehicle. It takes advantage of how simple a virus really is.
It's just a ball, essentially, that holds within it genetic code. There's nothing else to the virus.
That genetic code is instructions for making more of the virus. Scientists replace the genetic code of the weak virus with instructions for just the spike protein from the coronavirus.
So what happens is the virus attaches to cells, enters cells, and then that protein, the spike protein, is made inside your cell. So you make an immune response to the spike. You make the spike protein and you make an immune response to the spike protein. That's the way the Ebola vaccine was made successfully.
And that's the strategy the Oxford University AstraZeneca vaccine uses. The third and newest method delivers the genetic blueprint directly into cells inside microscopic fat bubbles.
You just directly inject that gene, which is then taken up by muscle cells, and that gene is then translated to the protein, which you then make an immune response to. Those are the mRNA vaccines that are being made by Pfizer and Moderna and others.
There's no guarantee any of them will be safe and effective. That's why tests on tens of thousands of people are underway now. Experts are hopeful for results by the end of the year. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website. China has launched an anti-dumping investigation into Australian wine imports as trade tensions between Beijing and Canberra continue to fester. Phil Mercer has the details.
Australia owes much of its recent prosperity to China, its biggest trading partner. Last year, two-way commerce was worth $170 billion, but cracks are appearing in this valuable relationship. Australian wine growers are the latest to be caught up in escalating geopolitical tensions. Exporters are accused of cutting their prices and taking market share from local companies in China. An anti-dumping inquiry has been requested by the Chinese Alcoholic Drinks Association. It will examine whether Australian firms are being supported by government subsidies. Canberra has insisted wine sales to China have been fairly priced, and officials have said they would cooperate fully with the investigation. Trade Minister Simon Birmingham says Australian winemakers have done nothing wrong.
We find these suggestions deeply troubling and quite perplexing. Australian wine is by no means subsidised. It is by no means sold at or below anything other than market rates in the world market. Indeed, Australian wine during the first half of this year proved itself to be the second highest priced wine sold in the Chinese market.
The investigation comes against a backdrop of increasing friction between Beijing and Canberra after the Australian government called for an international investigation into the origins of COVID-19, which first emerged in Wuhan, China, late last year. China recently imposed tariffs on Australian barley, suspended some beef imports, and told Chinese students and tourists it wasn't safe to travel to Australia because of allegations of racism. China is also suspected of orchestrating cyber attacks on Australian institutions, allegations that Beijing strongly denied. But Matt Canavan, a federal government lawmaker in Canberra, accuses China of economic coercion.
It's a pattern of behaviour we're seeing from China, and I don't think they can be a trustworthy business partner anymore the way they're acting. And I think every Australian business must be very careful about how much they get exposed to a jurisdiction whose behaviour is increasingly threatening and bullying.
China has insisted its anti-dumping investigation into Australian wine would be undertaken in a fair and just way, according to the law. A foreign ministry spokesman denied suggestions it was politically motivated. As bilateral tensions grow, analysts fear that Australia's lucrative iron ore and coal exports could be next to suffer. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Robots can do heavy, repetitive work and never tire, but they still can't approach a task with the intelligence and judgment of a human. Now there's a hybrid solution, a wearable robotic exoskeleton that gives humans superpower. Matt Dibble has that story.
Though it appears to have marched straight out of a superhero movie, the Guardian Exo exoskeleton is ready for work in the real world. It's a wearable robot that amplifies its user's strength, made by Sarcos Robotics. Chief Operating Officer Chris Beaufay explains.
Anybody who's wearing the Guardian Exo can lift up to 200 pounds. It really augments your strength, your performance. You move the way you normally would move. So if you were to go to grab something to lift it, that responds to your movement and gives you that strength to do that activity.
The Exo carries all the weight and transfers it through its legs to the ground, making 90 kilos feel like only 4.5.
Whether you're big, strong, small, man or woman, you can do the same task.
At a recent demonstration, audience members experienced how an exo arm gives them super strength.
Whoa.
Keep going.
Oh my God.
Strapping in takes only a few minutes, and once on board, the exoskeleton responds to the user's body movements. Tara Scranton, a Sarcos employee with only a few days of training, made wearing the exoskeleton look easy.
So this robot is
very intuitive. It follows me, does what I do. I don't have to think about it.
Bofei explained that hundreds of sensors in the device are responding to the user's movements.
We have something we call get out of the way control. What this allows is any operator to jump in and actually just move the way they normally would, and the robot is constantly getting out of their way.
The first XOs will find work in the military and the airline and construction industries, says Bofei.
The second most common reason for someone to miss work is back injury. They're getting injured while they're lifting heavy equipment, while they're doing repetitive tasks, and the exoskeleton can take the burden from the operator through the exoskeleton and eliminate that injury.
Though the Guardian XO would be useful for chores around the home, for now it will be going to industries that can afford the $100,000 per year rental fee. For VOA News, Matt Dibble, San Francisco.
Sudan has fired the foreign ministry spokesman following comments in which he said that the African country looked forward to making a peace deal with Israel. The spokesman had said his country is looking forward to concluding a peace agreement with Israel. The remarks, which came on Tuesday, drew a pledge from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to do all that's needed to wrap up the deal. The development comes after last week's bombshell announcement of a deal between the United Arab Emirates and Israel to normalize relations, which will make the UAE only the third Arab nation after Egypt and Jordan to have full ties with Israel. And finally, taking a look in today's history books, it was on this date back in 1848 that the New York Herald newspaper first reported the discovery of gold in California. And in 1964, the musical group The Beatles opened their first full-fledged U.S. tour as they performed in San Francisco's Cow Palace. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production staff, thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to visit our website, voanews.com, for all the latest news and information from around the world. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
USAID has been active from Morocco to Iraq and almost every country of the Middle East for between 30 and 50 years, said USAID Assistant Administrator for the Middle East, Michael Harvey.
It has been a sustained, long-term partnership that has really been focused on building these countries' abilities to take control of their destiny and to build a future that they define for themselves.
In a recent interview, he noted that a lot of the money U.S. taxpayers have spent in the region has gone into creating things that, while difficult to see, like potable water systems, touch people's lives every day.
But probably the more important thing that USAID has been doing over these last 30 to 50 years is building the human capacity in countries across the Middle East. So there's just been a tremendous amount of money and time and effort spent on training doctors, training teachers, training ministries of finance, ministries of planning.
What makes him most proud, he said, is to walk on to almost any university campus in the region and realize that much of the faculty was trained in the United States, often on USAID scholarships.
We have seen how this decades-long investment in people and human capital is having a powerful impact on bringing modernization and bringing new ways of doing business and organizing society to these countries.
Mr. Harvey pointed out that for much of the Arab world, a dramatic modernization is going on. The challenge, he said, is that the pace of modernization can be slower than the expectations of the region's youth.
And that's why we see young people coming out on the street in every country from Morocco to Iran. They're all talking about the same thing. They want government to be accountable. They want it to be honest. They want it to be transparent. They want to have a voice in how they're governed. And they want to see their economies modernized, opened up. They know what a normal country looks like, where you can travel and you can invest and you can build a business. That's the future that they want for themselves.
As it has for decades, USAID will continue to support the aspirations of the people of the Middle East as they work toward that future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.